Welcome to the Education Pre-Hospital Care Research Forum Journal Club. Here in our PCRF Journal Club, we promote evidence-based practices by critically evaluating the latest science in emergency medical services. We hope our discussion will help advance EMS practice. Through the generous support of our sponsor, Limmer Education, we can make science more accessible and understandable. Welcome, everyone, to the September 2024 Pre-Hospital Care Research Forum Education Research Journal Club. The PCRF promotes research literacy to advance the science of EMS educational research. So here with the PCRF Journal Club, we take a closer look at some of the latest research happening in medical education. Thank you to Limmer Education for sponsoring these podcasts so we can bring you the best of science in education. I'm Megan Corey. I'm here with Dr. Kim McKenna and soon to be joining us, Dr. Bill Toon. And today we're going to discuss this article entitled Using Artificial Intelligence to Create Diverse and Inclusive Medical Case Vignettes for Education. This is an article that was published this year in the British Journal of Clinical Pharmacology. It is an open access article that you are going to want to pull and read. It's extremely well written, very easy read, and it'll give you all kinds of ideas and resources for your education program. This article came out of the Netherlands, and so I wanted to mention something because we just met some researchers from the Netherlands at EMS Expo. And let me just say, we've had a very busy month. Kim has been at these, both Kim and I were at NEMC in Pittsburgh. We've had just a very productive month for the Pre-Hospital Care Research Forum. Last month, we were live from Pittsburgh at NEMC. We were joined by Dr. Heather Davis and Sahej Khalsa, who picked the article of that month. We were discussing faculty growth mindset and the impact of simple messages, even by email, on growth, about growth mindset and how it can impact student outcomes. And then most recently, we were in Las Vegas at EMS World Expo, and we had saw firsthand the results of a year of research summits and other research activities with a record number of posters and submissions. There were 5 oral presentations, including the World Trauma Summit, the Best of International Education or International Research. We had an education research oral session and 2 clinicals. So there were 5 oral sessions, and just there could have been even more. There was so much research integrated into all of the sessions, and there was a commitment to research that you could hear threaded throughout the conference. So that was really great to hear. And just congratulations to all the researchers that participated. And if you're out there and you're thinking about it, there are going to be some more of these research workshops coming up this year. We've got one coming up in November in Utah on post-crash care. There's going to be a few more in the spring that focus on equity, sponsored by CareStar. We've got a number of things that I think Vineman is also sponsoring another research summit. Nemesis is sponsoring the one on post-crash care. We've got a lot of things happening in the year ahead. And you can count on that abstract deadline too in June. It's usually June 30th. So start thinking now, maybe participate in a summit. If you don't have the time, maybe one of these sessions will give you some ideas. Certainly, I think this one gives lots of great ideas. We were having a great discussion before we even came here. And if you want more ideas, remember, you can always go to our YouTube channel, youtube.com/@PCRF at UCLA, and listen to some of the past clinical and educational research sessions, and maybe something will catch your ear. We certainly have associates that are mentors, Dr. Remley Crowe, Dr. Tony Fernandez, Kim McKenna, and I in the world of education. We're all out there ready to mentor folks who are thinking about doing research, or maybe you're in the middle of a dissertation. That's another one. We'd love to hear from you and help you along the way to completion and to participating in research. So that's just a summary of what we've been doing, and we want to begin today with this article. And we're going to begin remind you that you can either put your questions or comments in the chat, use the Q&A. We can bring the chat stuff into the conversation. We have a smaller couple of us today, and because everyone had a lot of stuff going on right now, right? September's a busy month for educators. So this article, we know that the foundation or the issue that they're really, basing their research on is that we know that creating case-based learning practices, that's a best practice, even replacing sort of traditional lecture with case-based learning, whether it's in discussion groups or scenarios, or even basing a lecture on cases, is a best practice in education and promotes retention and better outcomes for students. And that fully immersive simulations and scenarios and others, they all anchor on the ability to develop good vignettes, good patient care vignettes. But the vignettes that we create or that have been created, kind of we have a tendency to oversimplify relationships between the patient's demographics, the patient characteristics, and their medical conditions. And of course, we know, we've talked a lot about this in research recently, it leads to bias. And we know that downstream effects of bias could mean that it impacts patient outcomes. A lot of attention recently on algorithms that are created based on a patient's race. So you see a lot of articles and pieces on that. And again, if it comes all the way back to education, the initial education, then the development of these cases is really critical. So the other thing that we know is, and Kim and Bill and I can definitely attest, if you're our age, creating medical cases was really based either on, unfortunately, sometimes either on just kind of, shooting from the hip, the calls that people run, which could have some good foundation, but really have to have the detail and thought put into them from an educational perspective, all the way to the sessions that, and Kim, you've written a lot. You've written a lot of books and you've done a lot of text, supportive materials for educators, but developing cases can be really complex and challenging and labor intensive.
It really takes a lot of time, and to try, especially when you're doing initial education and you're trying to develop a comprehensive, really well thought out group of, scenarios and simulations, it takes forever to be able to get that sort of level that you can sort of scaffold them at the appropriate level. Mm-hmm. We were lucky enough one time to have a light duty paramedic who wrote some of them for us, and then I could go back and edit them, sort of like this article, right? They were able to generate at least a baseline. And as with anything AI, you can't just take it at face value. These authors learned pretty quickly that you have to go back and edit it to make sure that it hasn't made false assumptions, based upon the sort of algorithms that it has, because it's only going to output what has been input into its system. So.
Yeah. And what we're doing is saying that was our brains first, creating these and putting these into the systems. And frankly, we see this with students too. When we have, if you've ever had students develop cases, you can see the kind of societal issues come out as they're developing cases that that are very stereotyped for, like skilled nursing facility nurses. The certain characteristics will come out that that are very stereotyped based upon their point of view and their own biases.
And that's why it's super important to make sure that you have pre-developed scenarios and don't just tell your adjuncts when they walk in for the evening, just give us a good drug overdose call or a good, whatever kind of call it is, because they're going to potentially embed biases if you do. And so you really, designing scenarios has to be very purposeful, because it's, it's a tool that has to be carefully inserted at the appropriate times into your education plan.
Yeah, and it's challenging because at some point you're like, how do I know? How do I know with my group of educators who are, you know, maybe from a similar demographic or, you know, that and different than the population of students or the population of patients? And how do we know that there's biases in it? And some of that comes back to, we've got to also re-review these cases with that specific question in mind, not just debriefing the scenario itself with the students, but also with the faculty, and maybe even with a larger community, like you know, public members of advisory committees or other people at the college that are, you know, looking into something like that would be a good idea.
Well, the authors,
or entry education.
The authors sort of pointed out the difficulty that they had, you know, trying to get diversity without representativeness. You know,
yes,
I think that's a challenge. I don't care who you are or how knowledgeable you are. You know, you want to introduce people to learners to different groups of people without sort of telling them that single story. I was telling you before the podcast started that there's a great TED talk by a writer by the name of Chimamanda Adichie, and she talks about a single story, how it's so easy, especially if you hear a story again and again and again about a group of people, to paint everybody in that group the same way. So, you know, these authors were really mindful of that, I think.
Yeah, I think that's, and like you were saying, also, you mentioned representativeness versus, or not versus, but in addition to the diversity, and authors talk about this in their discussion section just beautifully. I think it's the discussion section is worth a read alone. And it's the representativeness, meaning, of course, we do teach bias into our training because we teach risk factors. And, you know, we say, okay, if these are the risk factors, the older you are, the more likely you are to have a stroke. If I give you a call, we even talk about this. So if your dispatch is a 78-year-old with an altered mental status, what are you thinking on the way to the call, right? It's in that national registry first circle of the clinical judgment model. What's your cues and what are you thinking? And we say, okay, the likelihood is it's a stroke versus, you know, where are we going? Maybe it's an infection, maybe. And you start, then all of a sudden you say, okay, it's not 78. The patient's 18. Okay, now I'm switching. My likelihood is, you know, seizure, drug overdose, you know, all of these other things kind of climb to the top. And we teach students about this because it's, you know, the risk factors. Where is the line between, you know, identifying that representativeness, which is what we're talking about, risk factor identification, versus, you know, diversity of, you know, it doesn't have to be, you know, always the same case. So,
yeah. And they talk about that in the introduction as well, just saying how, oh, it could really help you. However,
yeah,
it can also influence you to anchor on something and go down one path where you might fail to consider other alternatives.
Yeah. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think age is a great example because it's so easy. Mm-hmm. You know, there's that sort of that number, that chronological age versus that biological or functional age.
Yes. And, yes.
People hear that number and assume one thing when in fact they really have to look at the whole person.
Yes, exactly. So I think what they really wanted to do in this study, there's a focus here also on that whole idea of productivity of, you know, if you have to sit and create cases, or if you're using, even if you're using cases that you think are well developed from some of our existing coursework or some of the courses that are out there. I mean, there's certainly AMLS is a case-based, you know, education program. If you have PHTLS, you know, ACLS, AMLS, you have all these cases, PEP and PALS and everything. And these are developed cases. And if you're using developed cases, there's, you know, that's one aspect of, you know, taking a closer look at that. You can use those. And then, but in terms of having a large and diverse repository of cases to use that is kind of open to everyone to apply to their own. They really wanted to look at the feasibility of using AI. And they've had some experience. These researchers have already had experience using AI and testing it out, for the purpose of creating a repository. And I really appreciate the purpose of creating a repository that's open education resources, that's OER, you can have out there that's available to everyone. So their objective then was to assess feasibility of utilizing this AI-powered chatbot, and they wanted to use the OpenAI version, even though they all had the paid version of ChatGPT. And ChatGPT, the kind of upgraded version, I've spoken to people, I think Aaron Donathan, who's a researcher and has done some has done some AI generated cases. She actually experimented with AI, the ChatGPT, the higher model, being able to interact with you as a patient by voice. So there's that whole world out there too. In this case, they were looking at being able to generate authentic, diverse cases that can be reused. And we're talking about kind of printed cases for discussion. And this was in a clinical pharmacology program. These were for a specific use, but you could see that they could be expanded to use in simulation as well. And then customized it so that they can go out into an open education repository or resource repository within that, that you can use within your local educational context. And then again, enhancing that accessibility for all medical educators. So that was their objective. So they're really looking at feasibility at this point, but they do later talk about their next steps, which is going to be trying all of these cases out. So the methods, and Kim and I were talking about this a little bit before, this is where I'm trying to kind of walk through how did they begin doing this. And they did start with what most people start with AI, which is the single prompt. You start with ChatGPT and you use some kind of single prompt, and they, rapidly, even if it's a single prompt that you think is complex, they rapidly found out that, not specifying the age ranges or something like that led ChatGPT to create relatively young patients. So they knew that they had to, they quickly found out that you really can't use a single prompt, and that generating cases through small incremental portions of patient characteristics that yielded better outcomes for their project. So this was kind of an iterative process from what I can see, that they had small incremental portions of patient characteristics. And then what they wanted to do was generate this table of fictional kind of patients, by prompting it to generate names and ethnicities that reflected, and then they, again, you'll see some of the inputs to reflect the diversity of Amsterdam, which is their location. So you can actually input that in as well, reflect the diversity of your local area. And then they went, additionally one at a time for characteristics. And so you can see some of the things that are separated here. These are some of the randomized characteristics and how they had to create connections between certain things. Otherwise, it would create, I think one of the examples, Kim, was a 70-year-old pregnant patient or something like that. It would create something that was implausible, but you wanted to still, there was like this balance. We want you to create some things that could be, but not are, completely implausible.
And they also found evidence of bias, right? Because when they put in occupation, for example, they put in cook, and the system automatically generated somebody with a big BMI, with a high BMI.
Yeah.
And when you put in French.
French.
Then that automatically generated somebody that would be a wine connoisseur.
I thought that was interesting. So, I guess I'm assuming that is part of what we were talking about, which is ChatGPT is getting information from basically all of us, right? It's out there getting information from potentially biased sources as well. So That's the other thing to remember. It's really about, I think in this case, creating realistic, diverse, inclusive cases that can be representative as well as diverse and inclusive. And also to reduce that workload, to be able to do this in a large volume way to immediately. And I don't know if people have ever done this, but please put it in the chat if you've done this, if you've been able to, you know, if you've used AI to generate scenarios and then taken a look at whether or not how it functions. I know it works with some of the programs that are out there. Mike Main has a program I know that has, if you click a button, after you enter, like, this is my scenario that I want, it will actually generate an AI generated case study. I don't know if some of the other programs out there have done this. So Dr. Bill Toon is joining us. Hey, Bill.
Hi there.
I was saying it was just Kim and you and I, and we're like the generation of creating scenarios either by shooting from the hip or from, you know, right, long, long sessions of thought and written out scenarios, and we're handling this article without any of our youngsters out Katie O'Connors and Mike Caduceus.
You know, the people who actually use this stuff.
Yes, exactly. So it'll be interesting. I know Michael Caduceus and Katie have used AI generated case studies before. And in this one, again, they're using them for discussion, but I believe they've used them for simulation, which is interesting.
I was just going to say, Greg Fries is saying in the chat that he's used AI to generate short patient assessment scenarios. So I think increasingly it's sort of an awareness thing. Once people realize you can do this, then, you know, people are going to start experimenting with it. So I think that's a good thing.
Go ahead, Bill.
There's no question about it that this may be a time saver. You know, it may get to the point where it is reliable enough that it doesn't have biases and stuff, and the content is good. There's always going to need to be, I still think right now, that overread, you know, does it reflect your practice within your region or how you're preparing your students and stuff. I still don't think it's at the point where it's freelance, but how do we, I think the big question is there an ethical component to using AI, and does it cross a line, or can it cross a line, and is there a time when you shouldn't use it? You know, I it brings up a lot of questions that, again, we need. It's growing faster than I think we can develop some of the best practices out of it right now.
I agree. There's so many what ifs when it comes to AI. That's a whole other discussion for sure. A lot of places now, and even these authors disclosed that they used ChatGPT and how they used it in the preparation of their manuscript, because, you know, there are so many different ways. Chad Knox is pointing out in the chat that he or she has used ChatGPT to make games such as EMS escape rooms, and used it for the differential diagnosis game. That sounds like an incredible game.
That does sound like a great game. Again, OER, Open Education Resources. That sounds like a great thing. And then what I'm really wondering from the two that have put in into the chat, how do you afterwards then go back and check, or at least discuss things like, is there any threat of bias in here that could impact either the patient care, basically the patient outcome? So I'm wondering if that, even if you're creating cases, maybe in the debrief after a scenario, or the debrief when we're asking these, you know, clinical questions in the debrief, what's your differentials and what are you basing that on? one of the questions focusing on, is there any inherent bias in this? Do you think there's any inaccuracies or anything that could lead us to judgment and affect the patient's outcome? So I'm wondering if that should just be added as a reflection post-care. And, you know, what Bill was saying, I think, too, the ethical issues, I think that leads to some of the things that, that we mentioned earlier, which is the algorithm, you know, things like race-based algorithms, looking at those in internal medicine and in primary care right now, as to whether or not they're even appropriate. And, you know, and whether it has why, where they came from and what, how it affects and impacts patient care. Certainly we saw that with pulse oximetry, and we're seeing that in terms of, you know, putting things into an algorithm, whether or not that's going to unfairly affect a certain population of patients. So,
well, you know, I worked with a group with Katie and some other people with a research project, and we looked at just not only mannequins, you know, do mannequins create a consistent scenario that doesn't reflect the population? And then even when we go through a group of scenarios, how many of them show age and ethnic diversity within them? And then how do students reflect based on the kind of scenarios that they were given, you know, if they were given a Black patient or a Hispanic patient or an Asian patient versus a Caucasian. Yet again, as most people know, the vast majority of mannequins are Caucasian, predominantly male, and lack really true diversity. And we did find, and I wish I could cite it and stuff, Katie, where are you when I need you? She would jump right on this and everything. Mm-hmm. We found it to be very interesting. And I think the same thing could happen. How do you assure that the scenarios or the situations are reflecting the population that your services or your school, even students, are exposed to?
Mm-hmm. It actually opens up a discussion of social drivers or social determinants of health as well. So even if you do look at your local community and you do find, you know, risk factor patterns or whatever, that should open up a discussion about, you know, why that occurs and what are the social issues and environmental issues around it. So that's another thing that we see here, social identities built in here. And then Kim and I were talking about these gray areas, the little gray squares. They call those, quote, dummy variables. And what they want is when they're going to generate an image, when they're going to input all of this and get these cases, and they're going to ask for an image from Adobe Firefly, they're going to build that in, and the case, rather than put it in writing. You know, adding occupation and ethnicity and subculture, and then it comes, the image created will be based on that, not it written out in a case study, not in form of writing. So I think I got that right. And then the, you see what characteristics are on the medical alert bracelets or which things are relevant. And they were saying, you know, it isn't perfect. You know, they're still, they still see some things that, and they recommend in the discussion that you're going to get this huge table of data. That's what they have a description of having this, and you'll see it at the end of one of the tables, that putting it into a CSV, file with the, you know, like a spreadsheet. And then, they used Microsoft, Word Mail Merge. And Mail Merge is, if you've never used it yourself, you probably have an administrative assistant who has done it. They use it for your, you know, certificates and things like that. But you can select the data fields right out of the CSV file, and then create what you're going to see, which are these patient, you know, vignettes that the students can then review. So this is just kind of a visual representation of the randomized characteristics and then interconnections. So one of the things they did mention was, you know, the interconnections again between some of the characteristics that you saw that in the image. So I put elements, this is a big table that's in the article, and again, open access so you can pull it, but it gives you, it's a great table, and it gives you the characteristic that they use, the prompt that they used to generate these cases, these 30 cases, and then the notes around it. They wanted to, you can see they limited their ethnic diversity to reflect Amsterdam, that created more representative population. They have, the notes really are, it's kind of the justification and issues that might come up with establishing this prompt. So,
you know, when you look at the depth and the detail here, I can't imagine how many hours it took them to get to a place where they were able to generate prompts with enough specificity to be able to get the output that they wanted. So they've done a great favor by sharing this, because you could take this as a framework and substitute in, you know, more critical patient conditions, or, you know, kind of different past histories, something customized to your own area. And I think, you know, this doesn't really do justice to how much time this must have taken them, because I've played just with DALL-E for creating images, and it takes a long time to figure out the right way to put in the right words to get the output that you're looking for.
Yeah, that's a great point. So here we have these, you know, basic characteristics, and then you get into the medical history, and you can see, you know, the limiting factors that they, you know, this had to have taken, you're right, Kim. I mean, I'm sure they experimented with a lot of this and said, okay, now we need to, you know, limit this, you know, by replace these examples with this example. And everything that you see with the little arrow marks here and the asterisk will give you like the details, but this was shortened actually too. And keep in mind what it's used for. So this is being used for a clinical pharmacology student assignment, where they're going to develop a care plan of patients with cellulitis. So all of them have cellulitis, but they all have different backgrounds and influences. So, and then you'll see, you know, anything related to pregnancy, lactation, allergies, disability, renal insufficiency. So they had some, again, randomized characteristics that they input into ChatGPT. And then the image was generated from Adobe Firefly. So, and that was, again, they used free versions. So all of these were free versions that they were able to generate this table from, to kind of keep this in line with the open education resource movement. But if you look at the note, they actually, so this is where they did the image prompt. And in the note, they describe how they prompted ChatGPT to output as a CSV with semicolon separators, preserving line breaks. So that way they generated this large table, and then they saved it using one of the free softwares, which is Notepad, or into a spreadsheet program. And then they were able to use Microsoft Word and Mail Merge to create what you're going to see here, which is in the next slide. And that's that they have four cases. So here's the first two. These are examples of case descriptions. And they had cases, again, for a clinical pharmacology and therapeutics assignment about cellulitis, where they had to make a treatment plan for the patient. And so you can see, you know, the different things. Now, Kim, we were talking, Bill, before you came on, about the idea of representativeness. So, you know, things like risk factor identification and association with things like age and other things, versus diversity, and diversity, and inclusivity. And one of the cases, one of the things they highlight is Fatima, this first case. This is in, they highlight the alcohol use here that ChatGPT generated was atypical for someone who is pregnant. However, you know, we're talking about representativeness again versus it's not outside the realm of possibilities. It's not like a 70-year-old pregnant patient, right? It's not outside the realm. So they kept it in.
Yeah, I agree. I had to look that up, 1.8 units. And so basically what a unit is like 10 mLs of pure alcohol. So basically, you know, she would be having like almost 2 glasses of wine or 2 beer a day based on this, this measure that they have, which I was not at all familiar with. But yeah, I thought that seemed perfectly reasonable, like in an EMS scenario, perfect, especially, or even in the pharmacology one, to leave that in, you know. So
you
that's,
know, it's also it's, you know, I may not be on the right path here, but it's interesting you talk about alcohol use, because we know now that they don't want pregnant people to be smoking and using alcohol and avoiding certain things. But I look back at my mom and I know that she was a drinker and a smoker for all of us.
Yeah.
You know, how things have changed with time also. So it also for some urban communities, it wouldn't surprise me that there would be patients that would be, you know, could be heavy drinkers and be pregnant or using drugs or anything along those lines there. So again, I think it depends on the complexity of what we're trying to create for the vignette, the, you know, the scenario.
Yeah, urban or rural.
I think, yes. And I think you hit on something there, Bill, with time, because I'm finding it now. I just turned 60 this year, and I'm definitely finding, not that that's a big deal, but I'm finding that the gap to be a bigger chasm between my students and me. And, you know, creating scenarios now, maybe there may be some influences there. You know, versus just the time, I think is really important. So do you have to in ChatGPT insert, you know, a timeline too, or a, you know, or will it generate anything that's not modern, or, you know, and not everybody's modern either. So that's an interesting thing.
I think that's where those human eyes on the output are really critical. This example in particular, is that a reasonable thing to leave here? Does it match with your learning objectives? Would it be something that you would have to consider in a situation like this? And then you're going to have to make that human judgment that above and beyond what the machine generated.
Mm-hmm. Now, this is a pharmacology program, so I would imagine they would know right off the bat, but even something as simple as, is that the right combination of home medications, or is there in there that is not plausible? You know, are these medications not used together? You know, something that to that level of detail, because that changes, and that changes, you know, not too fast, but it does change the whether or not a home medication is in or out. And then they go out and they come back in too, you know, they don't use them for a while, but then they decide, you know what, we're going to use those again. So all of that, I'm wondering if that was generated by, I'm assuming that this was generated, are all those current medications, doses 3 times a day, 1 tablet a day, are those generated? And I wouldn't even know if that was appropriate. You know, I would need somebody to review that,
right,
and know it.
Yeah, or how much of it was edited. But they said, like, for the cases that were generated, it only took about an hour to proof and correct or delete ones that weren't appropriate. That's not that much time for, you know, it's generating up to 30 scenarios.
Yeah.
So that was quite impressive to me. You know, that's a big time saver.
Yeah, I was just thinking as we're talking about this too, having an interprofessional group look at scenarios for, especially if you're generating a vignette like this that has so many pieces to it, does this look, you know, clinically appropriate to our clinical pharmacist who knows current medications, and does it look clinically appropriate to, you know, the OB folks, you know, that this would be, And it may say, well, that's an unusual amount of alcohol, but it's not outside the norm. Well, then it's kind of okay, or it's not outside, so outside that it's unrealistic. You know, rather than we do a lot of creating stuff in house with just us, and I'm curious about, you know, interprofessional review of scenarios too. Here's the next set of cases too. So we have, you know, Anna and Raphael, and these are, again, I'm assuming this is all generated and with very little, you know, editing, and then put into this format through a mail merge with the photo. So
I'm really impressed by the quality of the photos.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like, and they did specify that they wanted a photo output, because these image generators, you can do, you know, watercolor style or oil painting style. But I think for this application, it was particularly important that these people look as real as possible, because what they're trying to do is get the learners to consider, okay, based on my first glance at this person, what opinions am I forming?
That's right. That's right. I think too, the something Bill mentioned before, which was, you know, AI versus generating or versus mannequins. You were talking about mannequins. If you're trying to diversify your mannequins and, you know, you're getting more and more mannequins, the one thing that AI has the potential for, and virtual reality and all of those, is to create these for, you know, at larger volumes, so without as much cost. So if you're able to generate, but it comes with the same sort of bias, because I remember visiting one of the booths or something, and it was about a year ago, and seeing some bias, you know, kind of in one of the virtual reality scenarios. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. You know, look who the person is who's got a cocaine overdose. You know, it was a little, you could see, wow, there should be some feedback in here about, you know, and, but there's usually control. You can control whether or not you change the image or the person's age or gender or race, to, you know, to make it, to remove that bias or to affect it.
You know, I have I may have missed it because I read this relatively quickly. Is where are they referencing? You know, can they take this and reference it back to a student resource? You know, the scenario is the question. And that would be something I think that would even come up in creating EMS scenarios, because students would want to know, okay, where can I get more experience or understand? Will it reference back to my textbook or not? Or is it grabbing from everything off the World Wide Web, and it may not have that specificity for referencing? And I don't know if that's a good issue or a bad issue.
Yeah, what a great question.
Yeah, I think you could control it. They probably couldn't, because they had like the low level version. But I think in some AI systems, you can control where the data is pulled from.
Yeah, but the question would be would let's say all the traditional EMS text, would they be available? Could you say, I only want you to draw from these 25 books, you know, that are traditional EMS books, whether it be AMLS, PHTLS, all those different kinds of things, and only draw from those to build your cases from?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, that's a big concern of publishers right now, right? You know, that if you could digitize and put everything into AI and combine things from a book, would you ever even need a book? Mm-hmm. But yeah, there are simple AI algorithms in Google and some of the other platforms now, and they do offer citation, usually one or two citations sometimes at the end, but it's really an amalgamation of information they've pulled from everywhere, which is why you have to have your expert human eyes. Oh, Chad says you can ask it to include references. Yes, I think you can actually. That's a really good point, Chad.
That can be a plus or a minus though, too. Mm-hmm. So if those, it's again, ChatGPT is going to be limited by the you know, garbage in, garbage out principle. So if they're searching, you know, not so relevant biased resources, then you're, you know, part of the point of this was to get a good inclusive representation, and but accurate as well. So I think that, yeah, that's a it's an interesting point. I think you can limit it by a number of things. They did mention again, striking that balance between, oh, they did talk about loading times too. So there was an issue with kind of time, as long as they had to, they could strike a balance between, you know, what they enter and the loading times. But they got to a kind of a sweet spot where they could get exactly what they wanted in a short period of time. With once they got kind of a something down, they were able to. But I think your point, Bill, to references is we usually like to be able to say, okay, in this case, this treatment for heart failure for this patient is appropriate, and here's the reference for that. Or this, you know, your care plan, you know, here's the reference for the evidence for that, you know, plan of treatment and why this is, you know, a good path to go on versus not. And does ChatGPT do that? There's some activity in the chat. I don't know if you can see it, Kim.
Yes. So Stephanie is saying, be sure to check the references. They found that when they asked ChatGPT for references, that many times they don't even exist. And yeah, so that was basically Stephanie's comment. So yeah, buyer beware.
Buyer beware. Yeah.
I could see that if it is truly drawing from everything that's digitalized, that it would be maybe challenging to create back to a specific reference. But I do, as you said, I am aware of the ability for higher end programs to limit where it's doing its search or looking at. But again, it would be dependent upon, is the information that we want in that format available for it to search, would be the interesting question. So again, I think these are all this is the beauty of a study like this, is that it begins to generate all of these questions that we're going to be, you know, faced with. What do we know that students are doing on their own? You know, what intuitive student is going back and, you know, he seems to be performing well in class because he's out creating all his own little study aids using AI. You know, we don't know what's happening there along those lines. And or they seem to be very diligent, but their information is a little skewed because they don't understand the value or where their information is coming from. So they don't know how accurate it is. So they could be learning some bad habits. So it really creates an interesting thing. And then the other question is does there need to be a policy within education programs regarding the use of AI?
Yeah, well, one that's not limiting to the expansion and exploration, but that's not, that also represents, I would not want to be a librarian right now. That's all I can say.
I mean, think about like calculators, for example. You know, calculators came along. People said, oh, that's going to ruin everybody. People won't understand how to do math, that sort of thing. And so then you had to develop a framework around when could you use it? When couldn't you use it? You know, for a long time, the registry exam didn't allow calculators. And now it does. You
Isn't
know,
that hilarious?
You know, what are the norms at a particular time? And I think we're going to be wrestling this for the rest of, certainly the rest of my career. These won't be answered. But I think the big positive in AI is what efficiencies can it create
yes.
for educators, so that educators can really spend their time developing, you know, working on like planning and developing really meaningful content for the learners and spending time with the learners. So things like, I know educators that are developing lesson plans using AI. Now they have to, again, they have to go back and edit them, but at least that initial, you know, is spit out onto the paper, and then they can go back and modify it and go, no, I want to do this. No, this objective written in this way. And it's a time saver. I heard this week about an educator that has a large number of students that ask for letters of recommendation that uses AI to help generate those letters. Now, a lot of people probably wouldn't feel very good about that, you know, but again, they go back then and edit them, personalize them if necessary. And so there's just sort of, you know, the it's sort of possibilities are endless in this regard. And so I think we just have to, you know, take something like this and see how could you adapt it to your program. And, you know, keeping in mind that it is not the be all and the end all.
Yeah. And I love what you're saying there. I really do think that that's an important step in all of this is how can we, particularly since EMS education is typically low resourced compared to other allied health professions, how can that program director or program director, who's also the senior instructor, who also coordinates the clinicals, I could go on and on with their titles of everything they do within their program. Could it make them more efficient? And I do believe that, but I think it is important that we have that deep conversation about what are the limitations and what responsibility do you have, you know, because any technology can be used inappropriately. Historically, we have many examples of things that were felt for good that ended up being, you know, turned towards bad. So we need to have that healthy discussion. And I do think that, you know, professional organizations may want to eventually come out and take a stance related to artificial intelligence and where they do it at this time, and that it has to constantly evolve as it gets better, gets more refined. It's not going away. That I know, it's not going away, you know, so.
Greg Friess is saying that, you know, that he feels it's a great time to be a librarian because now the librarians have a new tool to teach people how to access information, right? So every yeah, profession true. Is struggling with this. And Stephanie is pointing out that in the mid 90s, when the internet came out, everybody had this same discussion. People are going to be stupid now because you won't have to think anymore. But you know what? Here we are.
Now it's more about the quality of the information, right? So yeah, that's a great point about the librarian. I was thinking it was, you know, it was challenging enough to help students decide to how to be critical of information, I think is important. The other thing is, I think the whole kind of way that we school, it's not really the world of education as much as is schooling, the way that we put it together in this kind of time-based fashion. And we talk about time-based versus competency-based and all this stuff. All of that is getting, you know, kind of shaken by AI and, you know, online learning and other things, other, you know, kind of open access and that kind of stuff. And maybe that's a good thing. I mean, maybe there's some things we need to rethink. Well, maybe it gives us our focus on student outcomes rather than, you know, on the process too much, you know, overemphasis on the process. And then ultimately on patient outcomes. And again, a reminder that the article, that the discussion section there, they really emphasize, look, it's essential to know that ChatGPT does not possess actual medical, biological, or social knowledge, that it was trained using a vast collection of texts sourced from the internet, including web pages, books, and texts mostly from the global north. So, you know, it's in our effort to try and create these diverse cases, we have to recognize that is the limitation of what we're doing. What we're looking at is, you know, a washing machine instead of washing our clothes by hand and a calculator instead of doing manual calculations. I think the efficiencies that go with it are really helpful. And it would be great if they could do, you know, and it looks like the, you know, there's a start on some of the quality of creating diverse, you know, patients. And I think it's about the mindfulness of the person doing the input. What is it that we think is important for patient outcomes and, you know, and for student learning? So, and they do recognize it, you actually, the limitations necessitate manual refinement. They highly recommend conducting comprehensive manual reviews of all cases to identify any potential inconsistencies. And then also to develop, to look at the inherent, you know, is there inherent bias? Adding that as one of your kind of debriefings, whether it's with your faculty or students or both, into the cases so that you talk about, you know, what are some of the elements of things like social history and determinants of health.
Yeah, I'm excited as with it, but again, at the same time, you know, I'll hold to a degree of skepticism. So how do we promote it at the same time, making sure it's achieving? And I really like what you said there. There's two things. I think the ultimate is can we use this to improve patient outcome? You know, is there a way by, and we do it by better student outcomes, and, you know, and can we link it together in a responsible manner, but not inhibited? I don't want to come out as someone calling me a Luddite for not embracing, you know, embracing this. And because
Dave's not here.
Far from that.
Yeah, we can't have Dave here calling you a Luddite. So
really, I really like your suggestion, and you've said it twice now about, in cases like the ones that they've built here, building in reflective questions for the learners to think about, you know, what if this patient had been this, or how did the patient's disability influence your thinking here? Just really asking people to reflect on how those differences in people might influence their clinical decision-making, I think is really, really a critical thing that you really hit on.
Yeah. So this is the, you know, I think what you're talking about too, Kim, the environment is very unique in EMS, because you don't get to bring the environment with you when you go to the hospital. And so they never see it. So all of the things that may be relevant in an environment are also a part of this, and how we create that environment, like in a simulation, that matters too. There's judgments in that. Where is the patient coming from? What does it look like? What, you know, is it messy, or do they have food, or you know, all these other things that could influence your thinking. That's another challenge in EMS that we don't see, and we're not going to see in some of these other fields. So in creating cases,
I bet you could, in addition to the person, create the bigger environment in this too. That would really be something, like, because you do make a lot of judgments based upon the environment in which you find people. Sometimes before, a lot of times before you're even in the house, let's face it, or the building.
Yes. Addresses, right? And we actually do that. And I have to call, you know, check myself on that. I give an address. And, you know, if I have students that already work in the system, they kind of go, oh, that address, you know. So,
you know, you have to make sure that you include a section on there where there's a little scratch area that lets off a particular odor if it's just a paper based program. You know, you can't lose it. You can't lose out that scent.
Yeah. Candles. That's what we need. We need a booth of odors at one of these conferences. I volunteer, Bill.
Well, they do, you know, they do make, you can get, which I think is really great, some neat little sprays that can add a interesting flavor, let's say, to the scenario. So I think those are worthwhile. The one last piece I want to just talk about AI is, what will AI's role be in evaluation and creating evaluations? You know, and what does that bring into the big picture down the line? Because again, students are going to be out there, particularly intuitive students that are really linked into this. They're going to be working on this stuff on their own. You know, there's going to be the wild, wild west of this by people who are just, that's their nature. You know, they're out there. So the role in evaluation will be very interesting too.
Great point. Great point. That's right up Kim's alley. And again, what National Registry has been talking about.
It can be used for good or for evil. I'll just leave it there. That's another whole discussion, I think.
Great. Well, we're at the top of the hour, so that was great. Thanks so much for joining us. Thank you for the contributions made in the chat. I don't know if we have any final ones in there, Kim, but...
Greg added a link to saying AI is analyzing and annotating police video, and the same tech could apply to a patient response. Wow, would that, you know, talk about evaluation.
Yeah.
Patient care, and again, could it be used for the good or for evil? You know, more and more people are videotaping calls, which is
Well, it, you know, body cam, but also could there be a way to improve patient care report writing to make it more efficient?
Yeah. Good. Oh, for sure. For sure. So much to talk about. And we're not going to end with AI, because next month we're going to be talking about another article that's related to AI. And you know what? There's so much on AI lately that I think it's just going to keep going. We're just going to keep this conversation going. I want to thank the authors on this one too, because they provided some, they are really after providing open, not just open resources, but they want to, they have plans to develop a comprehensive guide on crafting these cases. This is in their article. That details the challenges, opportunities, and to establish a discussion board where teachers can engage in conversations about the prompts, share their experiences, and collectively enhance their quality. We're going to keep an eye on these authors and see where we're headed here, because that, what a great resource that would be for all of us. So thank you all for joining us. We join us next time, next month, Friday, October 25th, we are going to talk about ChatGPT again. Can it generate practice question explanations? And this is for medical students, but we all generate test questions and we have to recreate them and everything else. And those explanations, which is a best practice to give feedback, they take time. So is this a new faculty teaching tool that we could, you know, take advantage of? So join us then. If you miss us, you can catch us on our YouTube channel. And before then, on Monday, October 14th, you can catch Dr. Remley Crow and Dr. Tony Fernandez in the Clinical Journal Club. Thank you all for joining us, and we hope to see you next time. We hope you have enjoyed and learned from this PCRF Journal Club. Please share it with other interested EMS professionals. An archive of past Journal Clubs can be found at www.pcrfpodcasts.org. You can also find us on Facebook at PCRF at UCLA and on our website at www.prehospitalcare.org. A special thank you to our sponsor, Limmer Education, providing education tools for success at every stage of your EMS journey.